You're listening to NS Brief number 152, Justin Miller. Hey there, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for another NS Brief. So on today's episode, we've got Justin Miller. He's an engineer at Mapbox, helping to build all of the iOS SDKs for integrating Mapbox maps into your apps. Well, that's a handful to say. But anyway, Janie is here discussing with Justin on how to get things integrated, also how things are implemented in Mapbox itself, using things like OpenGL and WebGL and all the other tricks and tools that hopefully you might need. So anyway, take it away, Janie.
Hey, I'm Justin. Justin Miller. I live up in Portland, Oregon. I'm the mobile lead at Mapbox, and we're basically building developer tools for web and mobile around custom maps, custom geocoding, data, satellite imagery, all that kind of stuff. I've been doing Cocoa since about 2002, 2003. And programming a little longer than that. And these days I spend most of my time in Xcode and a little bit of Android Studio.
Okay, well, my first question is, what exactly is a custom map? Like, what's the difference between what you're doing and what I can get just off of, like, the Apple Cocoa frameworks or the Google Maps?
Yeah, so the best way to think about it is like, when you look at something like Apple or Google Maps, the map itself with all the roads and the labels and water and all that kind of stuff is kind of this opaque structure. Like, you can't get into that really. You could do a little bit with what they usually call annotations on top of it, like points and polylines, like you put store locations or you put a path that the users traveled or a hike or a bike or something like that. But what we're talking about is all of those layers in between, like the streets and the buildings and all that stuff. All of that in our stack is built off of OpenStreetMap, which is basically like Wikipedia for maps. It's got like 2 million contributors. It's an open kind of crowdsourced community, and we're building open source software that works with that. So like, that's a starting point, but you could bring your own data, or you're making a running map and you could take the interstates off of it, or you're making a boating map and you could make the water a certain color based on different things. So it's generally much more custom than you'd think about with like the standard map sets.
See, when you were talking about custom maps, to me, like, my mental image that I had was something like the Marauders map from like Harry Potter, where you could go and you could have like on parchment and have it do a lot of different weird stuff instead of just having, you know, like the satellite view that you get from like Google.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that kind of thing. I tend to get a lot of questions about doing game related stuff, like in a virtual fantasy world, which is not really set up for. It's more for the real Earth, you know, and mapping to that. But visually, I mean, that's not to say you couldn't do that, but visually there's, like, we've done a lot of crazy stuff. Like, you could change the way text works. So we made a pirate map once that had this very flowy font, and then every city name that had an R in it, we tripled the R. So it would be like Portland. That's a bad example, but you know, like a pirate R kind of thing. And so you could have a lot of fun with it. We've done, yeah, exactly. That's a much better example. So like that sort of thing, or like we had somebody build an app once called Map of the Dead, which was a zombie map. It was basically like breaking into your local 7-Elevens for supplies and stuff like that. And it was all red and black and like super, super kind of fuzzy, distorted. And so you could do a lot of cool stuff. And I think that's really fun because it, like, I tend to think of it as, you know, especially iOS developers are super pixel perfect when it comes to designs and assets and your 2x and your 3x retina images and all this stuff. But then you kind of put a generic beige or gray map in, I think you should be able to do more. So that's kind of the tool set that we're focusing on, aside from like making it open source and a lot more knobs and buttons to tweak and bring in your own data or whatever. But just basically, like, think about that the same way you think about your design assets.
And I know I just did a talk at 360 iDev where I was talking about focusing on design. And I know that I'm going through and trying to write my first application for myself, and that I was putting together this design. And it just really bothered me because I was using all of these built-in assets from like Interface Builder because they were easy. You could throw an app together in like 2 weeks, but you look at it and it was boring and generic. And it made me feel bad to look at this thing because it was just so like, it had no personality whatsoever. So I'm just really happy that there are people out there in the community that are saying you can do really awesome stuff, like, you know, your zombie map and do interesting user interface things, and instead of just using all the built-in stuff that we get.
Yeah, exactly. It tends to look like the Cocoa Foundation's like tutorial stuff that Apple puts out. Your app looks like that. That's no fun. But I mean, the flip side of that is maps are like crazy complex. So that can be super intimidating to be like, well, I'm not a map person, or I don't have a world of data. And so that's part of the challenge for us, is trying to figure out how to make tools that give you a sensible starting point, but also let you kind of get into that stuff in a more visual way, in case you don't know what a road casing is, which is like the outline around a road when it goes through a tunnel and stuff like that. So it's kind of a challenge, but I think like just the visual aspect of it is important for mobile apps, especially iOS apps. And then what we're trying to do lately, we're basically building a vector-based render. So it's OpenGL hardware accelerated based drawing of the maps at 60 frames a second. And that's kind of another area where we're thinking in design in the sense of app experience.
Now,
So not just visual.
do you mind if I ask you, why are you deciding to do this in OpenGL ES? Just because, like, I could see it going in one of two directions. Either, like, you could have been used. I know that a lot of the drawing frameworks, like Core Animation and some of the other things, have gotten a lot more powerful over the last couple of years. And then, of course, in the last, year or two, we've gotten Metal. And it just, it, I'm just kind of curious about, like, is it that the frameworks that exist now for, like, Core Animation, are they not powerful enough to do what you need them to do? Or have you just, do you have a legacy code base where you had everything written in OpenGL back before everything was at a certain point?
Well, we have a legacy code base, and we actually wrote it all with things like Core Graphics and doing it kind of native to the platform. So as an example, the original iOS SDK that we built was, it utilized a UI scroll view, and then it had a CA tiled layer behind it. And so that would pull like raster tile images to piece in and show a particular area of the map. And that had various limitations. One of them is that CA tiled layer is kind of made for large images and PDFs and not network content. But I mean, the larger question of why we kind of started rewriting things with OpenGL stack is to actually draw maps. So maps come from data. Like you have vector data. You have a shape file is one of the file formats. You have CAML or GeoJSON or whatever you might have, a GPX trace, maybe if you have a GPS device. And to turn that into a map, you generally rasterize it. And the kind of the standard way of doing that until a few years ago was using some software that basically says, okay, I've got a file that represents all the rivers in the map, and now I'm going to draw them as blue, and I make PNG images that have blue rivers on them. And then those get downloaded to the client and displayed in some sort of tiling interface. What we decided to do, and we weren't like the first of the game on this. I mean, Apple and Google were doing this as well, but using OpenGL, you can actually take that data to the client, and then you can say, okay, I'm going to draw these blue rivers at 60 frames a second using OpenGL. So it was a combination of kind of building up a primitives library to draw things like lines and fills and text and stuff like that, but also leveraging the hardware through writing it for OpenGL so that you use the GPU and you could do this sort of thing in a really performant way on the client. And that kind of lets you change the styling of this stuff on the fly.
So
I don't know
then,
if I just threw a whole bunch of stuff out there, I know,
well, listen.
but.
Oh, okay. So then you have like a file format. So like, if I go into something like Blender and I go and I create like a set of like points that I want to import like a 3D object into something like OpenGL. So you have something similar to that, only instead of rendering something that looks like a mouse, you have something that's a map and it represents all of the different point all the different aspects of the map.
Yeah, we basically built up a primitives library, meaning like we have a thing that lets you specify certain things to draw as a line, for example, a road or a river. Certain things should draw as a shape, for example, a park or a building. Certain things should draw as a point, like the store on the corner or an academic institution or something. And then certain things should have labels. And so we actually did all kinds of complex font stuff and rendered that in OpenGL. But the basic idea is you would take some sort of, and we came up with formats for this, but basically you would take data like I have a user trace that represents some hike that I did, and it's a series of latitudes and longitudes based on whatever the sample rate was in my GPS device and my iPhone or whatever. And I'm going to draw that as a line, and then our library lets you kind of style that at a higher level. So we actually wrote a styling language that's essentially based on JSON that lets you say, okay, take everything from this data source that's filtered by this qualification and make that blue 3 pixels anti-aliased 50% opacity or whatever. So you do it at kind of a higher level, but it's a short answer to your question. Yeah, it's kind of we started off with like a basically as a 2D overhead map, even though it is OpenGL. You usually think 3D when you think OpenGL, And we just figured we'd come up with these primitives for drawing squares and lines and shapes and dots and stuff on a map and let users bring data in and not necessarily have to be map people. They just have to stick to the common geodata formats. So hopefully that kind of answered your question. I mean, maps is like this huge can of worms. The further, the more you go into it, the more like explanation and data formats, and there's a ton of stuff going on. But
I'll try not to dig too far into all of my various questions about this, because this is really like getting me like I have lots of questions I'll probably talk to you about later.
No problems. Yeah, so it's cool stuff. Yeah,
you said you initially used Core Graphics. I know like Mark Dalrymple was doing a talk about Core Graphics where he was a big proponent of using it for user interface stuff. And I know when I was learning programming that a lot of people like, oh, you don't want to use Core Graphics because it utilizes offline drawing and it's really inefficient and, you know, you don't want to use it for anything. But then like when I was talking to him, he was talking about if you have like a static image on the screen, there are a lot of really cool things that you can do with that. And I just was kind of curious. I know that you said you were moving away from Core Graphics, but were you at least, was it at least performant for you? Were you able to utilize it in a way that was useful for you back when things were a little bit more limited?
Yeah, I've always liked Core Graphics. I like you know, drawing stuff in a like a little context and then rasterizing it and applying it to a layer or a view or whatever. I think the library is really good. There's some cool stuff you can do. It was working fine for our needs, but the deal was basically that we were doing maps as rasters. So all we really had were these rectangles, these 256 pixel squares that were pre-rendered map content. Basically, the flow is somebody had made them, uploaded them to a server, they come down to the iOS side of things, and we just like arrange them like puzzle pieces on the screen. So there's only so much you can do with that, because it's like the road colors already chosen, the road labels, all that stuff's baked in. It's just a raster. It's like a photo. So like the decision to go OpenGL was not, I wouldn't say it was like a weakness of Core Graphics. The other thing we had to think about, aside from like wanting to give people the ability to customize maps in a really fluid way and kind of a styling language level on the client, was that we're also doing it on Android. We're doing it on the server side, hardware accelerated AWS instances and Linux. And then you have a development environment of doing it on the Mac and the Linux desktop. And there's embedded applications like in-dash, you know, car navigation systems. So we decided if we could do this stuff at a lower level with OpenGL and C++, then layer like first-class things on top of that for Cocoa Library, so you have a first-class UI view-based interaction and a model that you'd expect from coming from MapKit, Apple's MapKit, for example. We thought that would be the kind of the best of both worlds. But that said, it's like a huge amount of work, so it was not a shortcut, but the reason we did it was not due to any like inherent limitations in Core Graphics per se, or like the iOS libraries.
Okay, well then that explains my next question about why you wouldn't consider doing this in Metal, because Metal is not a cross-platform thing.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. The other thing is, yeah, like I looked at that and I was like, oh, okay, this sounds cool, because like I had started feeling the pain of OpenGL and Metal, you know, okay, Apple's kind of rethought all this. But it's kind of two things. Yeah, the cross-platform aspect of it. And the other thing is, like, based on what I've read about Metal, so like a reasonable number of draw calls, like this is like OpenGL draw calls when you're drawing your frame of OpenGL content, is like 500 calls, I think is a safe ballpark from what I've heard. And we're in the range for most map views of like 300 to 400. So we're like in a safe zone. And what Metal gives you is the ability to do like an order of magnitude, like 5,000 draw calls 60 times a second. And so like that kind of overhead is not something we're needing. We're not doing like, you know, particle systems or fog effects or like all this kind of thing that you might get in a more gaming oriented approach. And I think that's really where, you know, that's like what pushes the envelope with OpenGL. And so I think that's what Metal's kind of targeted to. So it's kind of dual. It's like, well, we don't need that much headroom. And oh yeah, it's not cross platform.
Yeah, I know I've talked to Brad a little bit about trying to implement things in Metal, and I know that his opinion is kind of similar to yours, that if you're not doing a lot of draw calls, that OpenGL usually does kind of what you need it to be doing. But I know that talking to like other people in the community, a lot of them are like, well, it doesn't matter if OpenGL can do what you need it to do. Apple's clearly moving in this Metal direction, and eventually they're going to stop supporting OpenGL, even though, you know, it's been like 20 years and they still support Carbon.
Yeah, right.
So it's just interesting to hear a lot of different people's perspectives about why they do or do not decide to go in particular different directions because of, you know, we're all kind of, you know, doing this thing where we're reading the tea leaves of what we think that Apple is going to do and what direction they think they're going to go into.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, yeah, I mean, it's it definitely feels like, you know, they're going to want to put the brakes on OpenGL, but that's like a huge thing to unwind out of, because you've got all these, you know, Apple doesn't want to hear it, but a lot of people have cross-platform toolkits, right? Like, you get into like medical imagery and all these different applications for OpenGL, and games too, for that matter. Like, sure, you know, iOS is going gangbusters and that's where the developer revenue is, but like, people still write things and deploy to both mobile platforms or to consoles or whatever when you're talking about a gaming context. So I think it's going to be a while still before you see like super hard pressure to get off of OpenGL. And that said, like, I think there's some ways we could adapt things too. I don't know. I mean, I haven't looked at it at a deep level because there's a lot going on in our toolkit. And for the time, like, I'm definitely got my head in that zone of like reading the tea leaves, because you always have to be doing that. I'm always like looking for every little bit of info to see what is Apple thinking about? Like, what did they let slip? What are they revealing? Where's their head at? You know, beyond what they tell us at WWDC and in the docs. So, So I don't know. We'll see. I'm not going to say like, oh no, we'll never do metal, but it does, you know, it's not in the radar right now for those reasons.
I think you're one of the few people I've talked to that actually does maintains and supports cross-platform development, because I know a lot of the people I've talked to have decided to kind of throw all of their chips behind Apple. And I just, like, what are some of the challenges that you have? I know you talked about how you probably can't implement Metal, at least for a while, because you can't implement it on Android and web development stuff. Like, what is a unique challenge you have as a cross-platform developer?
Yeah, I mean, the main reason we do that is we are trying to build a platform. We're building developer-focused tools, and so you'll frequently have people come along and they'll be like, well, I mean, my app's on, you know, my business app or whatever enterprise app is on Android and iOS, and you guys need to be on both too. So that's kind of the reasoning for why. It's challenging. I mean, so the way we're building this library in particular is we're doing it in C++, pretty modern C++, C++ 14, and then on top of that, binding Cocoa and Android APIs. And that's pretty easy to do on the Cocoa side of things. I mean, you can basically, you can write Objective-C, you could change the file extension to .mm, and all of a sudden it's Objective-C++, and you can drop line by line into C++. That is super handy for debugging, for integrating, for all kinds of stuff. It's a heck of a lot harder on the Android side, so that itself is just a challenge of like step debugging and in that environment and just doing all that stuff. But also just by virtue of the fact that these things are all kind of tightly coupled, it's a fairly large project that we've got going. It's on GitHub, actually. All of our software tools are open source. That's not where we make our money. So I've been trying to learn from other projects and then link out like things we've learned in terms of like, so we use Travis for continuous integration, and we have like this huge build matrix. Every time you commit, it has to build for like 8 different Android platforms and 5 iOS platforms between the simulator and the device. And so just the complexity there is a challenge.
So then are you primarily sticking with Objective-C then? Because my understanding of Swift is that Swift doesn't play well or at all with C++.
Yeah, that's right. So like what we're building for the iOS bindings on top of this is all Objective-C, Objective-C++. And then we test that pretty heavily with Swift, both in terms of like the internal app that we use. Like we have an app that we built, pure Swift, and we integrate our what we call our GL library, this toolkit, as a static library, as kind of a third-party consumer would. And so that tests that bridging and then also makes sure that our auto-generated headers and all that stuff feels good, so that you're able to write stuff in a Swift idiomatic way. But yeah, I don't see any roadmap from Apple as far as like being able to go straight from Swift into C++. That would be nice, because I'm basically writing all my stuff that I can in Swift these days. But that's kind of the state of where things are. And then I think about that and I was like, oh, that's a bummer. But then again, I go back and look at the Android side and I'm like, okay, I could be a lot worse off. This is going line by line between Objective-C and C++ makes me pretty happy. So
now, I know my first programming job that I had for a couple of months was working for a company where we basically were creating user interface stuff from an API. So we had like an Android team and we had an iOS team. And I know that the management at that company said that they wanted everything to be exactly the same between Android and iOS. So like there was a thing where we were trying to figure out how to get people to know where they were. And I was talking to them about how they can use iBeacons. And they said, well, we can't use iBeacons because they're not available in Android. Do you have any thing going on where you look at something in like iOS or Android and go, oh wow, this would be really cool, but this only exists in this one platform, we're not going to include it? Or do you try to kind of customize each of your implementations to be able to like take advantage of the unique capabilities of each of the platforms?
Yeah, I'd say it's the latter. I mean, this is particularly challenging because so we're a maps framework, a maps and location framework, and it turns out both the mobile platforms we're shipping on, Android and iOS, those vendors make their own maps framework, and they're a heck of a lot easier to install than third-party stuff. So we've already got a bit of friction there, and so everything we can do to be most like them on each of their respective platforms, as well as like easiest to install, is like super huge to us. So anything we could do that makes it feel friendly, so like from an iOS point of view, like just number one, having Swift support, but also like heavily testing it and making sure that things work, like that's definitely a direction we go in. And like to give you an example, we kind of go back, dive back out again at some of the lower levels. So for example, this isn't really a user facing feature, but for like string processing, we sub back out of the C++ stuff out to the individual platforms when you do things like capitalizing strings or uppercasing strings, because stuff like NS string is super rich and it doesn't make sense to write all that kind of stuff in C++ when you've got really nice handling for it at a higher level of both Java and Objective-C or Swift. So, I mean, there's not a ton of whiz-bang stuff going on because it's basically what we're building is a view, you know, a map view that you interact with and do gestures, but it's all, you know, first-class UI gesture recognizers and that sort of thing, and it's got pan inertia and rotation inertia and all those kinds of things. But, you know, there's not a lot of other stuff. So we just try to support syntax where possible, where you bring things in and work with modern syntax. Like a good example is the new Objective-C, what's it called? Generics, I guess, where you have like typed containers, you know? So we built that up so that when in the delegate methods, very similar to the way MapKit now does it since this past WWDC, when you take an array of things, you know, you actually type the array and then you could type check up front for the developer that they pass the right things in the array and not an array of strings or NS numbers or whatever. So yeah, little things like that are more developer focused. They're not whiz bangy, but they're the stuff you see day to day as an iOS developer. So
now I know you mentioned that you had your tools open sourced, and you mentioned that wasn't where you guys made your money. I know before we spoke on the record that I mentioned that I thought it was interesting that different companies were able to actually have viable products that were based on things that were like available elsewhere. Like I know I mentioned Shinobi Controls and how they have basically a paid version of Core Plot, and that was a thing that was that they were able to make a business out of. So I guess I'm kind of curious, like, what is your business model? How are you getting people to pay you for something that they can sort of get for, like, you know, in air quotes, free through just the basic Android and iOS frameworks?
Yeah, so I mean, the basic way the business works is we bill for essentially map usage or map displays. So the number of times a map shows up in the app and the amount of bandwidth of like tiled data that's downloaded. The interesting thing is that's in kind of contrast to two things for the app developer marketplace. Like one, controlling your cost per user because you have a fixed price on an app per user. You sell your app for 99 cents. 30 of that goes to Apple, and then you want to know that if you are paying for maps, like a penny or 2 cents or whatever is going to the maps provider. The other thing is, like, you don't want to get penalized for your app getting popular. And so one thing we rolled out pretty recently was a free tier for up to 50,000 active users a month. And the way that works is, like, it's kind of a two-way street. If you want to do that, that's cool, but we actually do anonymous data aggregation around location that help improve our maps. So an example might be if a bunch of users are using, you're a customer of ours, you're using an app and you've got navigation or you're doing transit or something like that, and we see that in aggregate, people are no longer making a left turn at XYZ. That's the kind of thing we can automatically flag in our systems and see if our maps are up to date, that a left turn is no longer allowed there. So it's much more than like just the visual aspect of maps. There's a lot that goes into the data of routing and geocoding and like, oh, they're driving across what we thought was a field. I bet you there's a road there now. So, like, anyway, short version, the business model allows to scale up to that 50,000 user point in exchange for that anonymized data. And so that is one of the ways that we're able to do the system. But basically at a higher level, you just pay for usage of the maps to deploy across apps. And we tend to do like a long-term contract with customers who are building that into like an enterprise app, for example.
Now, why were you kind of excited about working on maps? Because I know, like, for me, before I started talking to you, I was like, oh, this sounds kind of like, I don't know, but after listening to you, this sounds really interesting. Like, what got you excited about doing this?
Well, there's lots of different things. I mean, for one, for me, it was personally my first. I mean, I've been involved with Mapbox for 5 years now, which is basically since the beginning. So when I came into it, for me, it was my first time building developer tools en masse and not beyond like a utility, like actually building for developers as the customer. So I really like doing that. I've been a CoCo developer for a long time, so it was fun to like use my knowledge of what felt good and didn't feel good there to build a tool for other people. But I mean, maps in particular, I think we're kind of building, we're at this foundational level now, even 5 years in, where what we're trying to do longer term is make different types of apps possible. So like if you use your standard map view from say Apple Maps, there I mentioned before, it's like it's kind of this opaque map that you put your stuff on top of. So there's like two things going on. There's like Apple and all their maps, and it is their map. It's their style. It looks, it's their beige, you know, it's very beige alert. It's kind of like, and then you put your points and your polylines on top of that. What we're trying to do is kind of bust that open so that you could make an app. If you're doing a running app, you downplay or even remove interstates because they're not relevant to a running app. Or if you're doing a nautical app, you do different things with the water, with the color, or maybe you use OpenGL shaders to do some cool effects there. Or you want to do things offline. I mean, that's something we've supported in the past and are working on with a new tool set, is let you take maps totally offline, which you can't do with MapKit. So that's exciting to me, to like make these use cases where people can think about maps in a different way and not like, okay, I've got a store locator, I'm going to put a rectangle here and put the store locator, but like start to think about the way a user moves through space and how that relates to location and maps. And what could you do if the sky was the limit and you could change anything or everything about the way the maps look? Because, oh, by the way, you can with our toolkit. So that's the most exciting thing for me. And doing it with all this vector rendering stuff in OpenGL means it can start to have kind of a video game fluidity to it, because you're rendering the map 60 times a second. And so it can be more like a movie or a video game. Not quite so sensational as that, but like you're able to like change aspects of the map over time with transitions and animations and things like that. And not just stuff on top of the map, but the core of the map. So I'm excited about that. That's cool stuff.
Now, I know you were talking about maps on like a macro level, that if you can create a map that tells you about how to get to a store and that you have access and all this other stuff. I'm just wondering, like, how what is the scope that you have of what you're capable of doing with maps? Like, if I wanted to create a map inside of my, you know, college and be able to tell people, you know, if you want to get to, you know, this classroom, you take these directions. Is that something that is possible, or is that kind of beyond the scope of what you're able to do right now?
Yeah, it's we're doing a lot of things. I mean, the biggest component of it is visual maps, like you'd think of the rectangle in your app. But we also have a directions API so that you can send up to points and get back. And you can also send waypoints, like stops along the way, and you'll get back a structure of, you know, what the turn-by-turn directions are for that. And we actually have a Swift library that wraps that nicely for people doing iOS work. We have a surface API that kind of lets you upload your own data and query an elevation or a temperature over a particular 2D space. And so you can make weather maps or things like that. We've got geocoding, which is that stuff around, you know, changing an address into a latitude and a longitude, and a latitude and a longitude into an address. So all these kind of building blocks of geo, we support a bunch of stuff like that and let you put your own data into it. And so yeah, it's kind of like where we want to go eventually is allow you to do anything around anything geo in your app, not just the visual map. So you might not even need to show a map in your app. It might just be about directions. Maybe it's about speaking the directions into the user's ear while they're using your audio history narration walking tour app or whatever.
But
So,
we're still talking about rather large, like,
yeah.
conceptual things. Like, I wouldn't be able to make like a map of like the Louvre and have people go through and be able to do like a tour of there, but using your maps, because it's just, it doesn't receive information on that macro, on that micro level, correct?
Yeah, that kind of speaks to kind of the limitations of GPS on mobile devices. Like indoor mapping is a whole nother thing, and that's where stuff like iBeacons comes into play, and things like, you know, sub 1 meter accuracy or sub even 10 meter accuracy, particularly when you're indoors and out of your GPS signal. So I mean, technically you could use our stuff for indoor map rendering, but you wouldn't do directions or like in store, like go down aisle 5 and pick up your toothpaste kind of thing. Yeah, that's kind of a whole nother realm, and the people who seem to be working there are doing stuff with both iBeacons, but also like routers and the MAC addresses in routers, and figuring out like which corner of the store the users are closest to based on Wi-Fi strength and stuff like that, kind of iBeacon-esque. So that's not really in the realm of what we're working on day to day. It's more your outdoor mapping,
okay,
kind of stuff and travel generally.
Yeah, I don't want to keep asking you questions about
outside of your. No, that comes up all the time. Like just like the fantasy gaming thing, it's like, well, I mean, we got clear use cases. It's basically Earth and outside is kind of where the distinction falls, and that's like a large chunk of stuff, so it keeps us busy enough. But yeah.
I know sometimes it might be, I don't know if you get this or not, but like you get kind of pressure like, oh, you should be able to do like everything. And it's like, well, no, it's not really our business model to do everything. We have a very specific thing that we do, and we do it very well. And if we try to go and, you know, do all of these other things, then it would kind of dilute the product that we're selling. And you can't be everything to everybody.
Yeah. And I mean, the way we started out was just the maps. And then we've grown into things like geocoding and directions and these other things as time goes on. So it's not to say like indoor mapping wouldn't be part of it, because we want to kind of be this like Lego building blocks for geo and location, and that's still location, you know, even if it's inside, people don't care. So, but yeah, it's about focus, particularly in a gnarly problem like maps with the massive amounts of data and rendering and like directions, and it's a big problem space. There's a lot of people on our team, and it takes a lot of effort to like do a stack of this size. So focus is super key there. Yeah, and so you got to say no to a lot of stuff.
On the same vein of saying no to a lot of stuff, just out of curiosity, I know you were talking about like the zombie map and some of the other stuff. Do you guys do in-house design work at all, or do you just create tools to allow other people to do their own in-house design?
We tend to mostly do the latter. We have done some like strategic design stuff around just map design. Like branding, for a good example, is the Financial Times in London. We design their map because they host with us on their website. They do their maps in us. And similarly, we did a design for Square. They use our maps in their receipts whenever you do a Square purchase. And so we've worked with people in the past to come up with a custom branding, because you can use custom fonts in our maps and colors and all that sort of stuff. But it's usually kind of in line with larger strategic customers or enterprise customers. It's not like an agency sort of model where we'll help you with your app. It's more like thinking bigger picture with folks who have a really strong identity, like an established brand identity, usually larger companies. But we tend to refer folks to people we know in the community or use our tools or build things off of our open source tools or whatever for that sort of stuff. And as well as just like write resources to teach people how to do it themselves. But that said, not everybody's a map person. Not everybody has the time. So, yeah.
Do you have any war stories about anything that you were doing that was particularly like interesting or challenging, or that you're particularly proud of that you've worked on over the last 5 years?
Whew. Well, I mean, the last couple years, like getting into C++ and OpenGL simultaneously was gnarly, but that's been fun. That's good. I mean, I like it. It's got its uses, and it's hella fast, so it's a good way to write this stuff.
If you're not in pain, then it wasn't fun.
Yeah, right. I mean, a lot of the early stuff, the raster based stuff with like scroll views and tiled layers and that sort of thing, I had a lot of fun there, just in the trenches. I guess war stories would be like figuring out what things are not good for, you know, like that kind of stuff. Like I think I mentioned before, like CA tiled layer, awesome class. It's a really cool part of core animation, and you can use it behind like a scroll view for, you know, scrolling around the world. Turns out it's not meant for network content. And when you have maps that come off the internet, that's networked. And so it's just not meant to work as asynchronously and as cancelable. This isn't even a word, cancelable-y, as you know, like something that was designed first class for network content is. But, let me think of more micro. I don't know. Just figuring out, like, yeah, that's the big war story stuff. I mean, just a lot of learning along the way of, like, constantly being reminded how big a problem space maps and location are. And, that's kind of the stuff that comes to mind, I guess.
So, out of curiosity, how long did it take you to learn OpenGL? The reason I'm personally asking is because I spent several months trying to learn OpenGL, and then kind of life kind of got in the way, and I haven't been able to do as much with it. But people kind of associate me with OpenGL because I was doing a talk about it last year, and so people keep coming up to me like, oh, what did you do in OpenGL? And it's like, I didn't do anything yet because I haven't had time to figure it out. And I just kind of wanted to get an idea about how long did it take you to work with it to get to a point where you felt comfortable with it.
Yeah, well, I still don't think I'm comfortable with it. I mean, right? That's 2 years in. I mean, it helps that. So what I brought to this particular team and this project was a long background in iOS, Cocoa, you know, network performance, just kind of low level stuff. And a couple other folks on the team were much more skilled in both or either of C++ and OpenGL. So I was not the lead there, and I learned a ton. The other cool thing about this is we're building this same stack in JavaScript as well, WebGL, which I think is a little more approachable to just sit down and noodle with, because you don't have that compile, deploy, you know, even on simulator, you don't, you know, you just like open your text editor, save the JavaScript file, refresh the page. And so you can play with OpenGL a little more directly there. But I mean, timeline-wise, I started noodling with it in late 2013 and just like going through a couple tutorial books that I bought, mostly from a mobile angle, and just doing it in like the abstract, nothing related to maps, nothing related to our problems, but like, what's a shader? How's a shader work? What, you know, what kind of, realizing how much of your own personal library you have to build up yourself. Like, you're dealing with 2 and 3 member vectors or matrix math or these other things that come into play. And like, you've got nothing. You've got like a pile of toothpicks with OpenGL. You've got to start building your own, you know, structures out of it. And so, I mean, it still takes me a long time to spin up on a bug fix or a feature, and other people tend to lead out some of the more core, you know, rendering related stuff. But that said, I've spent some time in there debugging texture uploads and efficiency and stuff like that. And like I said, I'm still not comfortable with it, but it's a monster of an API.
Yeah, I know when I was doing my talks and I was trying to focus on stuff, that I tried to focus on shaders, because I felt like even though they were a fairly large subject, you weren't trying to like focus on everything. And I thought that it would at least be some small starting point that you could kind of get to be able to do stuff with. And I know that one of the things that I encountered that kind of has stymied me a little bit is my unfamiliarity with math that I haven't done since I was like 18.
Yeah, right. That's huge. Yeah, like, yeah, the matrix math stuff, or even just like dot product and these different things related to vectors. It's like, I had to like brush up on a lot of stuff. And it's funny, some of the stuff is just really, it's elemental and kind of quote unquote simple, but it's stuff that you pushed out of your head because you don't use it in a lot of other programming.
Well, it's stuff that you push out of your head, and it's also stuff that isn't necessarily presented in the most approachable way. Like, if you look at, you know, something, you see all these Greek letters, it's like, what on earth is this? But then, you know, like, somebody comes over and explains it to you, oh, it's just, you know, you're taking these two things and doing this. It's like, well, that's simple. Why can't they just say it that way?
Right. Mathematicians, the notation, they're gonna notate it all. So, yeah, I think shaders is a good place to start, because it's like, you know, since modern-ish OpenGL, OpenGL ES2, That's what does everything. And so if you can get, you know, people think of, or potentially think of triangles, and that's what you're drawing with OpenGL, but it's made of vertices and space, and shaders do things with those vertices and the pixels they become on screen. And that's what shaders are. And that's where all the fun happens. So.
Yeah, I know I got very frustrated when I was going and trying to find, like, beginning OpenGL stuff. And it's like, here, you can make a triangle, or you can make the spinning 3D, like cube in space. It's like, I don't know how to take that and actually make it into something useful. This is a pain. Why are you doing this to me?
Yeah. It was kind of like there's this balance between learning those fundamentals, or at least, understanding where they fit in, even if I couldn't write something from scratch, and then working with my coworkers who, in building this primitives library, so we have, like, a line shader, which is draws nice anti-alias lines of variable width. And we have a fill shader, and that's how you draw parks on a map. And we have a symbol shader, and that's what draws font glyphs, and puts them on the screen and rotates the labels when you rotate the map and stuff like that. So when you break it down like that, we have like 10 or 12 or 15 shaders, I guess, now. Well, actually, like, that's the pairs of the fragment and the vertex. So we have like 7 or 8 shaders, basically, that do these primitives, lines, fills, symbols, dots on the map, text on the map, that sort of thing. And so you can go into those and kind of pull them apart. So even if one of my other coworkers has built something like this up, I can still kind of go in there and figure out what the heck's going on with, you know, how does the letter G get on the map? Or how does this icon get on the map? Or how does this river line get drawn? And then play with it and see what breaks and what goes, you know, starts clipping in weird ways and producing bizarre triangles on the screen. And How many? Yeah, when that's one thing. When OpenGL breaks, it breaks spectacularly. So it's always it's kind of fun to mess around with because you can figure out like a million ways not to do things.
So then, would you say that having other people who were more familiar with OpenGL than you were was that kind of like a thing that really was a valuable resource for you in learning OpenGL?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we tend to. I mean, the way we work is mostly online via textual interactions through GitHub mostly and a little bit of Slack. So we tend to write about how we code and write about code and break it down and like explain it to each other. And so even like this one of the coworkers I mentioned who's the lead on C++ and OpenGL stuff, he's in Berlin. So we're 9 hours apart. And so we couldn't just sit down and go over it together, but being able to have a team of folks who are good coders and good communicators was hugely valuable to see, like, you know, linking lines of code and showing. We during the early development of this, we would have running galleries of OpenGL fails, you know, like as I was trying to build this feature, here are 10 images of ways it went terribly awry, which are always entertaining and lighten up the reading a little bit. But like, yeah, it was super hugely valuable to have folks who had a sense of how this stuff worked, or more importantly, could even just focus on OpenGL stuff, whereas I was doing a lot of different things like in Cocoa and business strategy and some other stuff too. So just having those sorts of resources on the team has been huge.
The reason I was kind of harping on you a little bit about this is because, like I said, I have a lot of people who come up to me like, oh, how did you learn OpenGL? And I'm like, I didn't really learn OpenGL. And
one
I
just, does not I, simply learn OpenGL. But, right? It's like a life progression.
But I feel like I have this like never ending quest where I want to find like the perfect like learning resource for OpenGL, and I feel like it just doesn't exist out there. And like it's interesting to me to talk to people who learned it and to find out that it's really hard to learn OpenGL from a book or on online resources, and that one of the best ways of learning OpenGL is actually to know somebody who can like sit down with you and talk to you about it and answer your questions. And I want people to feel less bad about not being able to figure it out on their own, because I feel kind of like, you know, it's one of those things that a lot of the knowledge is kind of institutional knowledge among people who already know it, and that you have to be able to find, you know, like a guru to go and speak to in order to be able to fully understand OpenGL, unless you're a super genius, which most of us aren't. But I don't think it's one of those things that only, you know, like two people in the world should be able to know how to do. It's something that should be teachable.
Yeah, it's tough. It does feel like one of those things where, you know, somebody locks themselves away in a tower for a couple years and that's the only way to come out, you know, on the other end, and just blood, sweat, and tears. But I mean, I have a couple books that I really liked that I worked through. I don't remember the names right now, but I'll send you the links and you can post them in the show notes. They're sitting over here on my bookshelf and I can't quite make it out from here, but I haven't opened them in a little while once I got through the basics. One website I do remember off the top of my head is open.gl. They got a great top level domain. It was http://open.gl, and it was WebGL focused, if I remember correctly, but it had some neat resources around like what's a shader and doing some things. Again, like I feel like all of the OpenGL, you know, things are pretty abstract because you're like, great, I have a teapot or I have a rotating cube or whatever. What I'm trying to do is build a first person shooter. But I mean, it's like I said, it's like this pile of toothpicks. You have to really kind of build everything up, and you got to know what toothpicks are, what little building blocks are at your disposal. It's funny because there's a lot of analogy to maps. Like I've been doing maps for 5 years now with Mapbox. Before that, I wasn't doing maps. I was just doing iOS development and sysadmin and some other things. And so I tend to have people come up to me and ask me all questions maps. And maps is a similar thing. It's a huge problem space. Like, do you mean 2D maps, 3D maps, routing, directions, geocoding, spatial analysis, point and polygon, you know, just presenting things, information density and Tufte-esque, you know, PowerPoint keynote ethos kind of stuff. There's so many things to what you put under the umbrella term of maps, in the same way that OpenGL is this huge technical topic, that it's the same kind of thing. Like, I am by no means, you know, schooled in maps, and we're trying to democratize maps a little bit, and I mean, part of our business interest is building tutorials around it too and teaching people how to do stuff. But it's like a lot of tech, it's this kind of combination between a little bit of self-teaching, but also whether that's written resources or just trial and error, but also like learning from others and needing to learn from others and spread the knowledge.
I know when when I went and started learning how to do programming, I just thought, I'm going to learn programming. And then eventually I kind of narrowed it down. I want to learn iOS programming. Then specifically I want to do, you know, graphics programming. Then within graphics, and it's just, I feel kind of like it's a fractal. Like every time you get closer and closer, there's still further and further down that you can get where it gets more and more specialized. And then you like go and talk to somebody about something that's, you know, like 10 levels up and you're just like, what?
Yeah, right. That's a thing. That's a thing I either build upon or that is so out of my focus area that I forgot it was a thing, and probably of at least as much complexity as the problem space I was working in. So yeah, it's kind of nutty how complex stuff can get.
Well, you know, like I talk to people, they're like, I know 20 languages. I'm like, no.
Yeah, right. I've touched 20 languages in some period of time, and you know, some of them are older and in, way off in the attic of my mind somewhere. But yeah, there's no way you stay fluent in that many at once.
Well, yeah, when I was learning programming, they were like, oh, you know, once you learn all of the rules, then it's just all like, you know, grammar and syntax. I'm like, no, they all have their own personality and their own feel and their own way of doing things. It's not just the frameworks, it's the actual languages themselves. They're all very different. And if you just kind of have this idea that everything is the same, and you just, as long as you know how to do like a for loop in every language, that you understand the language, I think that really, you know, takes away from the richness of the complexity of all of the different languages in our ecosystem.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, the thing I've worked, I guess the language I've picked up most recently, and I'm super noob in it, but basically it's Java. So I've been doing a little bit of Android stuff. And in particular, I'm implementing some features that I've done in iOS and did kind of, you know, they were very first nature to me, like doing them in iOS, like the delegate pattern and stuff like that. And then doing the listener thing that they do over in Java and Android interfaces is a little bit different. I learned from a coworker it should be an array because you may have more than one listener, whereas in iOS, you know, you only have one delegate. So that's not strictly a language thing. It's not just Objective-C or Swift versus Java, but it's also iOS versus Android. And if you just go in and write it like you would idiomatically in iOS, it's not going to feel right. And that's particularly important when, like, the project I'm working on is a developer framework. We want Java and Android developers to feel at home, and we want iOS, you know, particularly Swift developers to feel at home. So you definitely got to pick up the nuances, and that's, yeah, it could take a lifetime to master. You know, nobody's ever, you know, a master of it. It's a continuum. So you got super philosophical towards the this part of the interview.
Well, if you don't get philosophical during the interview, then it wasn't a good interview.
Yeah, right. Cool. I'm into it. This is great.
Well, I'm kind of out of questions. Was there anything that I didn't talk about that you're interested in? Now that you brought up that it's philosophical, you've killed the whole thing.
Yeah, right. I mean, how can we back up and start talking about shaders now? Yeah, no, I think I kind of hit all the bases. I mean, that's the stuff I'm thinking about these days. And it's fun also because I really enjoy working on open source stuff, because when I finish a big pull request or a big thing, I can then tweet about it and link people to the code, which is fun. That's something I couldn't do when I was a freelancer working on other people's iOS apps. So that's fun. I like kind of contributing back to the mindshare and the knowledge of how to do a thing, or one way to do a thing, you know, not the canonical way necessarily, but like, here's how I accomplished a thing. And so I'll definitely send some links over that you can put in the show notes, both around the OpenGL stuff, but also like repositories to check out and how to find me online if you have questions, or how to point me towards resources that would help me in my quest now that you know what I do. So yeah, that'd be cool.
Hopefully we'll get it out by the end of 2015.
Yeah, right. But yeah, that's kind of it. That's all the stuff that's in my radar these days. And yeah, it was good to talk on like a kind of a wide range of stuff, philosophical and OpenGL.
Well, OpenGL is philosophical.
Yeah, true. That's true.
It's esoteric and you know, like it's out there.
You have to go to a special place when you get into OpenGL. Just prepare your mind. Yeah.
There are foxes there with chunky bacon. Or wait, no, that's the Ruby space. All right, cool. Thank you so much for taking the time and for talking to me. And hopefully other people out there will feel less bad about not being able to master OpenGL in, you know, like a weekend.
Yeah, definitely. I hope I've helped people set their expectations appropriately. It's hard stuff. But yeah, thanks for having me on. It was a ton of fun.
All right, rock on. Thank you so much.
Great, thanks. Bye.
All right.
Show notes for this episode and every episode of NS Brief are available on our website, nsbrief.com. You can send any comments, feedback, or suggestions to our email address, show@nsbrief.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We are @NSBrief. You can find NS Brief on the iTunes Music Store. Just search for NS Brief and we'll be the first search result there. And while you're there, why don't you post a review? Every new review helps new listeners find the show. And we really love reading and sharing your reviews. And that'll just about do it for this NS Brief. We'll see you again next time.
You've been listening to NS Brief.